The UM Podcast is brought to you by Emma, email marketing that works for you.
In a world where QR codes kill kittens and customer service is an oxymoron, one podcast has set out to make things right. This is the UM Podcast with your hosts, Scott Stratton and Allison Kramer.
This week on the UM Podcast, we have to be quiet.
Why?
Because the puppy is sleeping underneath the table.
No, we can be loud.
Hey, all right. So Chelsea the puppy, the mascot of the show, who we'll affectionately call Emma right now.
We're not changing her name to Emma.
They're sponsoring the show.
They're not sponsoring the puppy.
I actually didn't tell you we did a life sponsorship. So the dog is now Emma.
Tessa.
Is now email.
Dallas.
Opt-in.
Lola.
Double confirmation.
And Sugar.
Spam.
And me?
I don't think I can tell you. Open rate.
Oh. I don't know how to take that.
Oh, we are so happy to have you with us, our fine seven listeners. Brought to you by Emma. Doing email marketing right, doing it well. I forgot the tagline they wanted us to say, but now it sounds more original when we say it. Emma, we're just better than the rest. Is that the one?
You can probably write them new taglines. They probably love that.
We love their new team. We love the crew there. Campaign Monitor, the company that owns them, bought Emma some time ago, and we are in love with the crew there. So they made us feel so at home in Nashville. We were there last month, and we already love Nashville, so it was hard to make it better, but they did. So to especially to our main contact, Kaylee, who's always up for anything that we're doing. We sat down and had a meeting with her at the event before we talked, and we're just like, so what else do you want to do? And we're just so, our excitement was matched by hers and obviously the rest of the team. So we had a blast.
We're definitely very lucky in the sponsor department.
Very, very much so. So we are, and as authentically as I can say, we are ecstatic with this. And
do you have an
happy
opening story that I don't know about? Like, so you have a piece of paper there that looks very mysterious.
Well, I wanted to tell the listener. I've been wanting to tell it for a while now. I just keep forgetting to bring it up about Boutique Air.
Okay, what's that?
And so I had a gig in northern Minnesota. And by saying northern, I mean it was quicker to drive from Winnipeg, Manitoba in Canada to it than it was from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And so I had a gig for a large distributor of electrical parts and giant company, billions in revenue. And it was awesome. Very cool company. And so we decided we went to the Vikings game that weekend since the Vikings were playing. And
which was awesome.
The show's contractor, our handyman for the show, Jay, our BFF, was a lifelong Vikings fan, which hurts me as a lifelong Detroit Lions fan. But I said, let's go to the game. So Allison, myself, and Jay went to the Vikings game. Beautiful new stadium. Oy, amazing. We stayed at Radisson Red, what we talked about in the show, right? Which was
the Millennial Hotel.
The Millennial Hotel had lockers in the room. It was just something. But I took Boutique Air. Did we tell the story on the show? No, we didn't tell it, right? No. So we went to, so we did, and so then after the game, Allison flew back to Toronto. And I decided to, instead of driving four and a half hours in Minnesota, because you never know the weather, or and after being all day and at the game, I was going to fly. And I just checked, and there was before going, I found out there's Boutique Air. It's like private aviation at commercial prices. And I'm like, okay, because I went on Kayak and to search how do I get from Minneapolis to Thief River Falls, Minnesota. And just to tell you how small that place is, a friend of ours who lives in Minnesota had never heard of it. And she's lived there her whole life. So we looked it up. Boutique Air is $96. And I'm like, all right. I saw a picture of the plane. It was the same plane that I took the famous private flight I did for the Buffini tour years ago. I'm like, here we go again. So I get to the airport. And obviously, MSP, you know, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is a hub. It's a big hub. So it's a big airport. I've been there anytime I'm going to Portland, I can always connect in Minneapolis. So I go to I'm looking for the gate, and it's like some gate I've never heard of. And I go to it, and then I ask Carrie, who's from our friend of Minnesota. I'm like, she doesn't even know where that area of the airport is. And I go, and there's like six people at this gate area where time has forgotten this area. And the woman who's working the gate, she's like, all right, so Scott, are you here? Like first name, First name. That's so small amount of people are going on this flight. It's first name. Scott? Like, what's up? She's like, hey, you here? Give her my bag because we're not fitting any bags. Like, there's no carry-on on this thing. They're going to put it all in the belly of the plane. And then we get out, and we're so she's like, all right, y'all ready to go? And the six of us stand up, or eight of us stand up, and we walk to a door, and we take an elevator down to the where, you know, obviously where the plane is, and we walk out, and the pilot's standing there with a little clipboard. He's like, Scott. And then he eyeballs me. He's like, your back row.
Yeah,
and
I'm don't like that.
What does that mean?
So I was, the only time that's ever happened to me is on a flight to New York. It was a very small plane. And it was like one of those like one and one at the front. And they made someone move.
Yeah.
They went up to somebody.
The weight distribution on the plane.
And they just said, like, you need to move. And they switched two people around. And that was the first time I ever realized that that could happen.
Yeah.
I did not like having myself be a factor in any way. In the functionality of the plane, in the way it was going to fly or land. I did not like the idea.
What happens if you stand up?
And like, they didn't like weigh these people. Like, it was just eyeballing. Yeah,
it's like a carnival. I'm guessing 190.
Yeah. Okay. You guys better move. And I didn't like it. It made me feel.
If this is a real thing, and I know it is, I'm not a conspiracy theorist here, but if this is a real issue and concern, there should be a scale outside of that plane. Yeah. Let's not guesstimate.
No, it really made me concerned. I don't want to be a factor at all. I don't want to be part. I don't want to be responsible for anything. I don't want to be a factor.
I've had it on flights where I just had it a few weeks ago where the flight attendant came back and said, okay, so our weight distribution's off. Like there's a thing, there's a sensor that'll tell you. And they said, so two of you in the first four rows got to move to the back. I don't care who it is, but we're not leaving till two go. And I'm like, all right. And I'm like, I don't want to. And the guy beside me is like, I'll go. So now I got two seats to myself. I'm like, you are a better man than I. So he went back and moved. So we get on the plane. It is not like the private flight I had with Buffini Success Tour. It is a private plane jammed with economy seats. Okay. So you're just all just stuffed in here and I get $90. Fine. Whatever. Get in there. But it's so funny. And I'll live through this, right? It's like Southwest, but worse, right? You're just all shoved at eight of you. It's sold out. Eight of us. And so the captain gets on, and the plane is so small. It's one of the a smaller jet. I'm used to the larger one. And the captain, to talk to us, has to stand outside the plane and lean in.
Because he can't stand up.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, everybody. Hey, I'm Jeff. I'm the pilot. That's the entire staff. And he's like, so there are some refreshments up here, like a can of Diet Coke and something else and thing. By law, we have to have a washroom available on the plane. And then he holds up a bucket. An empty bucket, and says, this is the bathroom. He says, I suggest you hold it, because it's a 40-minute flight. He says, I suggest you hold it, because it's a bucket.
Okay, so you know how there was a trend in hotels? They started having these, they called them boutique hotels. Yeah. And we noticed from going to several of them that boutique was just a word to make like a crappy little hotel seem like bespoke, like handmade, you know, like that kind of is very marketing kind of thing. So when I see now a hotel and it says like a boutique hotel, I'm going to imagine that all the bathrooms are buckets.
They're just buckets.
Because that's what I picture. Like that airline could not be more aptly named for the way I think about the word boutique.
And so the flight takes off and a small plane like this, you feel everything.
Did you use the bucket? No, you didn't.
I'm going to leave that up to everybody's imagination.
Nobody used the bucket.
I'm like, do you have anybody else dips in the bucket? Because I got
to
go.
How bad would something have to get for you to use that bucket?
I can't imagine. There's nowhere to use it, but there's no private bucket area.
No, I know. There's no, there's no bucket
but
area.
But in a display of dominance, I decided to go and make eye contact with the other seven people. And after that,
they were all our listeners.
I became the captain of the plane.
They were all our listeners.
Look
all
at me.
Seven of them.
I am the captain now. That's what it is. So, haven't even seen that movie, by the way. Only the trailer. So, we land. Everything's fine. We land in Thief River Falls Airport. And there's seven of us in the air. Like, there's eight of us there. And a guy is just standing there. He's like, hey, Scott.
You're all first name on this trip.
I'm like, yeah. He's like, I'm picking you up.
You don't exactly have an unusual name, though.
No, so we hop into his just car. It's not a van or a hotel shuttle, but he's bringing me to the hotel. And we're halfway driving there. We're halfway done. And we're talking. And especially northern Minnesotians are
nice.
Honorable Canadians.
Yeah,
so he's like,
nice.
Oh, by the way, I work for the hotel. And I'm like, yeah, I figured that. He's like, cool. And then we just kept talking about healthcare and all these other things. We get to the hotel and he drops. He's like, thanks, man. He's wearing regular clothes. And he just walks behind the front desk.
I'm just picturing like the, is what's the show called? You like, it's like a crime show. Is it the first 48 or something like that? Yeah. I'm just picturing like the first 48. Like, it's like Scott was last seen getting on a plane. He peed in a bucket and then a guy picked him up.
And that was it.
That was it. He just went with the stranger willingly.
So I go to my event the next day. And I meet the president of the company. He's like, hey, he's like, you made it. And I'm like, why is that a shock? And he's like, well, you were flying boutique air. I'm like, whoa. Was it a concern? He's like, well, it's not always the most reliable. I'm like, well, nobody, I sent you my flight info a month ahead of time. You just forwarded it around to your good time buddies saying, oh, look, can't believe he's taking this flight. Nobody informed me.
Why are you so surprised the bucket airline is unreliable?
Well, that's just that's a technicality.
It's not. The pilot said we're legally required to provide a bathroom and then told you when he met you all that they had not done that because in no way would any kind of government official look at a bucket and think, yeah, that counts as a bathroom.
I think it does.
No, I don't think it does.
It's like expecting a bathroom on a city bus. You just need to get on and hold it.
Yeah, but on a city bus, if you can't hold it, you can get off the bus.
You can get off the plane.
No, you really can't get off the plane.
Bucket chute. Just hold on to it. Anyway, there's a story I always wanted to tell you, which leads us to our first real story of the day. From metro.co.uk, from our friends across the pond, poo found on every McDonald's touchscreen tested.
Emma's going to drop the sponsorship
brought to you
of
by
the dog.
Emma.
Does this surprise anyone?
This is an article, okay? So, traces of feces have been found on every single McDonald's touchscreen swabbed in an investigation by metro.co.uk. Samples were taken from the new machines that have been rolled out at restaurants across the country. By the way, one thing that did not have poo on it, the bucket on the plane. Every one of them had...
You didn't have a scanner thing to test
that. Coliforms. I have it at all times.
You have a poop scanner at all times?
Yes, of course. It's called my nose. Senior lecturer in microbiology at London Metro University, Dr. Paul Mettleway, said we were all surprised how much gut and fecal bacteria that was on the touchscreen machines. These cause a kind of infection that people pick up in hospitals. Every McDonald's screen that was swabbed was found to have poo bacteria on them. The machines have been rolled out McDonald's branches across the UK. For instance, Enterococcus fecalis is part of the flora of gastrointestinal tracts of healthy humans and other mammals. It is notorious in hospitals for causing hospital-acquired infections. Unsuspecting diners choose their food on the touchscreens, then head over to the server to pick up their burgers, more often than not without washing their hands.
All right, people, just wash your hands. Go in the bathroom, use soap and water, wash your hands.
The screen at one branch was found to have Staphylococcus, a bacteria that can cause blood poisoning and toxic shock
infection thing.
Syndrome. Oi, oi, oi. Here's the thing. Just don't touch anything.
And if you touch something, wash your hands and don't touch your face. It's very early education stuff.
That was just a great story.
That's disgusting. No, you just wanted to read it because it said poo in the title.
I saw that and immediately added to the list for the show.
Okay. A small bookstore had to relocate.
I'm surprised I didn't lead with that. That should have been the opening. I'm sorry. I failed you all. I'm sorry. Go ahead, love. I called you love. That's not very professional of me. Go ahead, lady. Allison, continue.
Open rate. Okay. Customers
go ahead, open rate.
Customers and community members helped October Books in Southampton, England move locations by forming a human conveyor belt to help transport its books. For more than four decades, October Books has been a fixture in Southampton, England. Over the past 15 of those years, the independent bookshop has cooperative called 243 Portswood Road Home, nestled amid an ever-changing strip of cafes, clothing stores, and pharmacies on the city's main street. Yes, it sold books, but it also became a gathering place for people seeking a local, radical, and eco-friendly community center. So obviously the bookstore had a strong community around it, and last November, the co-op members gave their landlord notice that they would be leaving their Portswood Road space and begin seeking property to buy. As fate would have it, a former bank just down the road went on the market, 189 Portswood Road, and it was perfect for what October Books members had in mind. So basically, they decided they were going to move out, and a place down the street opened up. So people decided to help them move the books. Obviously, books are very heavy, and it would cost money and time. And so people lined up around on Portswood Road, almost shoulder to shoulder, and then pass the books from the bookstore to the new location. It's pretty fantastic. Mm. I like it. It said 250 people formed a human chain to help the independent bookshop October Books move from its old site to its new location.
That's great.
Isn't that a cool story?
I love that.
But bookstores can be great places for community building.
For sure, especially the independent ones too. They're really, the book lovers. They host book clubs. They host authors.
Yeah, and they get the flyers and stuff with community groups and stuff. I find bookstores, that's one of the things that I hope will keep bookstores in brick and mortar, is I think it's good to have a community around. It's like, it's nice. You find like people who are interested in the same topics. You have speakers come in. I think it's good. So
yeah,
it made me happy, that story.
I figured out Wayne's Emma name.
Okay.
Clickbait.
Totally.
Right?
I'm just glad that wasn't my name. I really dodged a bullet.
You could say he's a master at it. All right. So this is from QZ or QZ.com, depending on where you are in this hemisphere. There's a reason using a period in a text message makes you sound angry. Think about that for a second, right? So somebody sends you a text. If they put a period at the end of what they say,
I would call you immediately if you did that. Immediately.
When it comes to texting, the period gets a lot of attention. People have begun noticing slight changes to the way our smallest punctuation mark is deployed. From declarations that is going out of style to claims that it's becoming angry. What they're actually noticing is written language becomes more flexible, with texting possessing its own set of stylistic norms, sometimes informally called text speak or textees. Nobody calls it that. The period is merely one example of the shift, a change that has opened up new possibilities for communicating with the written language. Just as we have different styles of speaking in different situations, so do we have context-dependent styles of writing. Though periods can still signal the end of a sentence in a text message, many users will omit them, especially if the message is only one sentence long. This tendency now subtly influences how we interpret them. Because text messaging is a conversation that involves a lot of back and forth, people add fillers as a way to mimic spoken language. We see this in increased use of ellipses, which can invite the recipient to continue the conversation. The period is the opposite of that. A definitive stop that signals, as linguistics professor Mark Lieberman has explained, this is final, this is the end of the discussion. For some, this can appear angry or standoffish. In 2016, psychologist Danielle Gunrag tested how people perceived one-sentence text messages that used a period at the end of the sentence. Participants thought these text messages were more insincere than those that didn't have a period. But when the researchers then tested the same messages in handwritten notes, they found that the use of a period didn't influence how the messages were perceived. In 2007, study by linguistics Naomi Barron and Rich Ling, multi-sentence text messages often had punctuation to indicate where the sentences stopped, but only 29% of these texts had punctuations at the very end of the message. The reason Barron and Ling explains is that the act of sending a message coincides with the sentence final punctuation.
If you ever get kidnapped and you need me to call the police, send me a text that just says fine with a period after it, and okay. I will call the cavalry out and we'll find you.
Because you've said in the past, you said to people that you can tell exactly how I'm feeling just by how I text.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I can tell if you're tired. I can tell, especially when you're on the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell exactly how you're, but that's years and years of talking over text.
Yeah.
I mean, we've probably said as many things in text to each other as we have in person.
Right.
So it's a lot of years of communication that way.
Yeah. Well, and that's, so it's, so then it's texting. And here's obviously going back to the fundamental model of communication from the dark ages, right? You have the key thing, you have a sender and receiver of a message, right? You have two people facing each other. And then between you have the noise, right? That can cloud whatever the intended the encoding of the message of how I want you to perceive it, and the decoding of the message, which is how you perceive it. And in the middle of that is a noise. And why I know this model so well is because in my second year of college, a very snarky teacher who I loved said, who knows this context, the model of communication? I put my hand up. She's like, okay, you go ahead and you show us. And I drew the entire thing on the whiteboard. And she's like, huh. Well played. So in the middle of that, what you happened is how the receiver's feeling that day, how the sender's feeling that day, what has happened recently between the two of you, what's happening now in the world, and then the little thing. So now, that was before texting. And now that adds on top of it. So there's a period at the end of it. What emoticons are you using? Because it's different smiley, right? Depending on the smiley you're using too. And for us, right? I, when I, if I'm in the air I'll send you a three emojis or emoticons of an airplane, so you know I've hit the airplane Wi-Fi. So I'm hanging out. When I land, I have three of the two-handed signal of touchdown, right? And when I wake up, there's three kissy faces.
And what do the wake up three kissy faces mean?
Well, I'm on the road. It means good morning,
my love. And when you're home, what does it mean?
Good morning, my love. That's and what it means. And if you're getting coffee for yourself and you feel like bringing one to me, I wouldn't turn it down.
Yeah, my first answer to those is usually whether I'm home or not. I'm sorry. Like, I try and say, like, if I get your wake up text and I'm already out, I'm like, oh, just out. Because I'm like, he'll wait there forever to see if coffee's going to come back up.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. That's how it happens. But I do feel but I feel, though, because I think that also takes time, like any communication, obviously. Yeah. Like, it takes time to figure out how another person is going to receive the things you say, how another person is, what's behind the way someone's talking to you. And it's really complicated. Yeah. And certainly with practice, you get better at communicating with someone. And I think in text, that's just amplified because you can't see their face. Like, you don't have any of the other cues you would use. Like, if you're in the same room with someone, you can tell if they're angry, you know what they're doing. Yeah. Whereas with texting, you take everything out except the words. And so little things like punctuation or change, like they don't usually say that, all of a sudden can take on more meaning. And I think that it must be really hard to be at the beginning of those relationships and figure it out. Because I do think it's can be misread very, very easily.
Especially when it's written communication, which is, you know, you lose every visual cue.
Yeah.
Tone. Yeah. Right. So we've replaced tone now with emoticons. We've changed tone now with animated GIFs or memes, right? So the tone has come back a bit, though. So I actually think texting can actually be interpreted a little bit better than email, I think, because email was such a flat just text.
Yeah.
Unless you go all caps, which I've had to tell certain people that, you know, all caps means you're shouting. Right? People are like, well, no, I didn't mean, I'm just emphasizing. I'm like, it's universally known when you all cap something, you're shouting. If it's important, underline it. Do something like that. Yeah. There's a keyboard full of opportunities you can use. But when you all caps me, you're shouting.
But I do think it's like specific to a person. Like there are certain ways you don't answer questions that if you answer them, I would be like, that's weird. Like, you know, and that's the same as in person, but it's just so much more pure and difficult to read because you can't see someone's face.
Right. Very interesting stuff. And that's what you got to watch for, too, because I remember even Seth Godin, we had talked about this years and years ago, just one before really texting was huge, was just email. He's very short in his emails. And he explained, he's like, I don't want to somehow come off as terse, but he's like, he's going through 1,000 emails a day. He just gets to the point right away. And that can be interpreted as indifference to something or an attitude for something, too. And I realize, depending on who I'm talking to, I'm very short in text, right? So it's like just right to the point. And you can be interpreted as being surly, which I'm probably being
not much of an misinterpretation.
Speaking of misinterpretation, this
article is from Business Insider. It says millennials are killing countless industries, but the Fed says it's mostly just because they're poor. Like we've talked about many times on the show, millennials have been blamed for killing plenty of industries. But according to a Federal Reserve study, it's not their fault. Millennials long presumed to have less interest in the nonstop consumption of goods that underpins the American economy might not be that different after all, a new study from the Federal Reserve says. They said their spending habits are a lot like the generations that came before them. They just have less money at this point in their lives. It's so exactly what we've been saying all along. Says millennials are less well off than members of earlier generations when they were young, with lower earnings, fewer assets, and less wealth. Conditional on their age and other factors, millennials do not appear to have preferences for consumption that differ insignificantly from those of earlier generations.
Yeah.
So I want everyone to hear that again. They do not have different spending preferences, consumption preferences than older generations at the same age.
The cost of tuition is exponentially higher now than it was 25, 30 years ago. The cost of living, the cost of buying a home, renting, is exponentially higher than it used to be. And we're sitting there saying they're killing these industries. It's just not the case. Combine that with more choice, exponentially more choice in things now. We talked last episode about like Endy.
Yeah.
Are millennials killing the store mattress industry? No, the store mattress industry killed those. Millennials are killing American cheese. No, American cheese killed American cheese. Like, this is not a fault of the youth and the youth not being millennials even anymore. Millennials, I have a breaking story for you. You're old.
You're getting there. Our kids are coming up for you.
Wayne, you're old.
No, but I think that there's a focus, the focus that should be is on value. So like this idea that they have less money and more choice means right. that what we should see is really cream kind of rising to the top, where they have all this choice. And so products that at various price provide a ton of value,
right.
those are the ones that they're going to be buying. They're going to be much less into, they're not going to have the disposable income that we had when we were starting out. We didn't have that much, but that we had where we would just buy anything, or we didn't matter if you had to throw it out in a month or a year or whatever kind of product it is. They're more interested in something that offers more value. And like we talked about that a lot in the last book that we wrote, which
Unbranding,
which name just fell right on my face. Unbranding, where we talked about value. It's perceived value is really the key with tons of new technologies and tons of choice, because it's the value that's important. They want to know if they give you their money, especially when it's limited, that they're going to get what they paid for, that they're going to be happy with the product, that you're going to stand behind it. And so it's really good for businesses in a lot of ways, because you can use value to kind of stand out.
It's good for good businesses.
Well, that's well, it should always be good for good businesses. Yeah.
But the ones who have been sitting back and just like, well, this is your grandfather's place that you went to, or this is it's just not, legacy isn't as important anymore. Because I think because the biggest threat to legacy is choice.
But I do think that some of our legacy brands, the ones we really see kind of like weathering the storm of all this innovation, are the ones that value have always been core to who they are. Like we talked about Patagonia and Unbranding. Fantastic company, huge value, expensive products, but a lot of value in that they'll repair them for life. They take care of them. They have a certain mission and they treat their people really well. And they've created this company of value. So somebody will say, I will spend $100 on their product because I know I'm going to have that sweater right. and they're going to take care of it. And then we just saw them this week give away $10 million. They didn't give it away. They took the tax cut that they were getting under Trump and for $10 million and they put it towards an environmental cause. That provides climate, value. Change, that makes people feel that they're spending their money in a good place. And so legacy brand, old company, can make it through disruption by focusing on value. It's right. the most important thing.
It's just that, well, legacy doesn't mean you're not good. Like I think when you're looking, it's just no longer the default.
Yeah.
It's no longer because this is the place, this is what you do. It's no longer, well, since my mom bought this flavor, maple syrup, this cereal, and this thing, that's what I'm going to get. The legacy brands have a leg up because you're defaulting to them, but now the choice is so much higher and so much more vast, and you can reach me, excuse me, easier these days.
Yeah.
You can target by down to the individual, that it's fascinating.
Also, I think value is like a complicated concept. It's more, we're not just talking about money. We're talking about how the money is provides problem solving and quality and all these things. So like there's this idea that reviews are really, really important too. And today, so a lot of shoppers today, when they're going, it wasn't like you and I, when we were like, let's say get your first apartment and you just take whatever furniture you can, and you put it together. They have so many choices and they see so many reviews, and value can be really measured by reviews. So I just think it's this storm, you know, of all these things happening at once, the choice and the reviews and the access to all this information puts that value higher and make it more important for companies to focus on.
I agree. You want to do a made up word?
Yeah, sure.
Made up word. Don't make any sense. Made up word. Don't mean no offense. Made up word. It brings laziness. Made what is all this craziness? Made up. They're
made up. All right. So this week is brought to us by Christopher Penn, who did not submit this word. He just posted something on Facebook with
and
it in it.
And he took it.
And I took it. So I don't think that qualifies him for a
no, part. Sorry.
By the way, I didn't mention it last episode. If you find a made-up word, a word you see it's combined usually of two other words, which is known as a pantomime, I think. Two words combined.
Was it, I don't know. A pantomime?
I don't know. There's a name for it. A porte en bleu? I don't know. What is it called?
I don't know.
So if you submit one and we use it on the show, we will send you any one of our books. You can take your pick and we'll ship it out to you. This week's word is manalytics. Manalytics. What do you think about that clickbait?
He's not answering.
Wayne is not answering Manalytics. He's still hurting from last week's words, so he's not gonna.
It must have something to do with like stats, like analytics and men in some way. Those are the two words I hear. Yeah. I hear man and I hear analytics. So maybe making decisions based on statistics and stuff that have only tested or focused on men.
Close.
Okay.
This term was coined in reference to sports analytics like Moneyball and a trend of guys insisting they are smarter than machines at making sports recruiting decisions. So it's a big thing right now happening, especially in baseball, where people are like, no, you go with your gut. And the guy's like, hey, no, we're just showing you exactly what's happened over the past season, year, game, week, decade. Yeah. And it's like, is gut feel more than
analytics? Don't you think that applies to business too? I told you I listened to the newest Reply All episode, which we like, and they were talking about like hit choosing, like how to create a hit, like this idea that if we're in content creation, we're always trying to get a hit, right? Like mm-hmm. that's popular. But some people just have this instinct, like where they know what's going to work and they tend to like things that a lot of people like it tends to work out. Yeah. And that's all instinct and gut and experience.
Yeah.
But then if you put something on paper, like in the story, they were talking about rides created from games. And the first one they did was a flop. And so data would show they should never make another movie based on a ride that people don't like it. So this first movie flopped. So we're never going to make a movie again, except then they made Pirates of the Caribbean. And it was like one of the biggest Disney franchises ever. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to hear that, like when do you rely on the numbers and when are you just, you have a certain knack for knowing what's going to work.
Right. And I know I'm being a hit maker myself.
You are a hit maker. So that's right.
I understand that. All right, y'all. Hope you enjoyed those hits. We will talk to you next week as we approach
Christmas,
the festive season coming up. Happy Hanukkah previously. And now, merry upcoming Christmas and all that jazz. Get us gifts.
Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and visit theunpodcast.com. And remember, friends don't let friends use QR codes.